Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everyone. Today's Wednesday. It's the 14th of December, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. I'm so pleased and honored, really, to speak today to, of all people, Orrin M. Levin Waldman, who's a socioeconomic research scholar. His most recent article, or essay rather, is The Importance of a Social Contract, naturally written by Orrin M. Levin Waldman. So good morning, Professor. How are you, sir?
Good morning.
Well, your writing is always eloquent and so explanatory. I think this goes over most people's heads. They don't understand the importance of a social contract, and they may not even understand what a social contract is. And they don't even realize, on top of everything else, as I didn't, I don't want to sound like I'm the smart one around here, that it goes back to the 1600s. So how did we come about recognizing the need for a social contract, and did it begin in England, didn't it?
Well, it probably began earlier than that, but I think the presumption was that social contract theorists were trying to legitimize particular forms of governance, or specific governing arrangements. So they contrived this literary mechanism called a social contract theory, you know, assuming that people would enter into a contractual relationship with the sovereign. They would surrender certain liberties, mainly the liberty of killing one's neighbor, in exchange for protection. So they get freedom from an untimely death. So, in other words, if you have the liberty to kill your neighbor, your neighbor has a similar liberty to kill you. So what you want is you want some form of protection that the sovereign can provide. So a set of laws, governing arrangements, which give you basic protection. And different theorists had different ideas about what the social contract would look like. So Hobbes sort of had this idea that you enter into a contractual arrangement with a Leviathan, and it would give him absolute authority over you. So basically it's legitimizing monarchy, or absolute monarchy. And so the king provides you basic protection, but you surrender all your liberties to him. Now, that's not a liberal arrangement, but it's sort of a pre-liberal arrangement, because it assumes that you're a rational actor who has agency. You can think what your best interests are, and you've come to the conclusion that you're in your best interest to receive this kind of protection. Now, in extreme form, you could say the same thing exists when you have, people paying protection money to organize criminal elements. Okay, this is the same kind of arrangement, but it's not articulated in the social contract. But in some ways, they're very, very similar. Locke comes along, and he basically says, well, no, let's change the social contract. It's really you surrender certain liberties in exchange for basic protection, but you only surrender enough of your liberties for the sovereign to have sufficient power to protect your property. And for Locke, that meant that the property was an extension of yourself, because in an agrarian society, you're investing your labor into the property, which gives it its value. So if you encroach upon one's property, you're encroaching upon the individual self. So this was the social contract there. Then Locke went a step further. He went to say that the sovereign that does not protect property forfeits the right to be a sovereign, that the people are with their rights to rise up in rebellion, overthrow the sovereign, basically violation of the social contract. And basically justifying a form of revolution. What he's doing is he's actually providing legitimacy to what came to be known as the glorious revolution, 1688 in England, which basically, brought William of Orange to power. And you have a preface in the Second Treatise of Government where it basically warns him that be careful about what you do. Be mindful that you have limited authority. Do not act as though you have absolute authority because, the people that overthrow you for violation of a social contract can also overthrow you as well. Keep that in mind, that your powers are limited. Now, what it really comes down to is you're through the social contract, you're giving legitimacy to the form of government. And basically what Locke is saying is, okay, legitimacy is conferred ultimately through public acceptance and this idea of popular sovereignty, which is what we assume today. There's no such thing as really popular sovereignty in England. Basically, the monarch is sovereign, but basically the consent of the governed allows for the monarchy to have its power. The consent of the governed allows for the government of the United States to have legitimacy. How do we renew our consent? Well, we do it through the electoral process, basically by having elections on a regular basis and seeing that power is transferred peaceful transfer of power, then we basically can say, okay, this is a legitimate form of government. We don't have to resort to, violent overthrow of the government in order to restore popular sovereignty or to restore legitimacy.
Yeah, but does our government actually respond to our nation? Some people will bow down to government and think that it represents them, and others don't. And aren't we at a point where, as a nation, we're so divided? Who are we paying allegiance to? And isn't there just a lot of trouble? Trouble in River City, as they say.
Yeah, that would be the basic critique of social contract theory. Does the social contract encompass everybody? Is everybody protected by it? Does everybody have faith in the system that it works? And I suppose the short answer to it is, since we don't see violent demonstrations in the streets, nobody is amassing an army to overthrow the government at the moment. Hasn't been really. Even if you want to call January 6th an insurrection, it really was not on the level of violent overthrow of the existing government. So it's basically people still have faith that at the end of an election, especially a presidential election, where the president's term of office is up and the new president has to come into office, they have faith that there will be a peaceful transfer of power. Now, if you think about it, despite Donald Trump's machinations and his belief that the election was stolen, he still left office peacefully. I mean, he didn't do it in the most artful, tactful way of attending the inauguration of his successor, but he still left. He didn't call upon the military chiefs to prevent that peaceful transfer of power.
Well, it's very interesting because you're talking about a peaceful transfer of power, and in the city of Yonkers in Westchester County, we've had a mayor that was supposed to serve a maximum of 2 4-year terms were he to be reelected, which he was. And then he went to the city council, which was supposedly to mimic what they did in New York City with Mayor Bloomberg, when it was recognized by the city council in New York City that Mayor Bloomberg, during one of the most difficult times of the city, Financial Times of the city, paid for everything. He paid for Broadway to stay open. He paid for the hospitals to be able to conduct their business. He paid for the streets, paving and repaving, and for the police and for the fire department. He paid for the museums. He paid for everything right out of his own pocket. So thankfully, he was magnanimous, and at the same time, he had the means to be magnanimous. He did run for a third four-year term, and yet he demanded that the city council also put in a referendum that would forbid him to run additional four-year terms, even if he waited for a full term and tried to run again, and that this would be inculcated into future conduct of the city. And yet, for example, in Yonkers, we didn't replicate it the same way, and certainly the mayor of the city was not as magnanimous, nor did he have the financial means to do what Mayor Bloomberg did. But what's fascinating is that he's already been in office now 3 years, overlooked a referendum that forbade him from running a third four-year term, but he did anyway. And now we're at it again, where there's a prospect of him running again for a fourth four-year term. That, for the first time, is being challenged in the courts. So they just launched the assault on government. When do we recognize that the law is broken, and how do we put an end to it? So even in a small city like Yonkers, you know, you got issues like this that break the law, or so many people claim that it's the law is being broken. So where do we look?
Again, there's no easy answer to the question. I think that if you don't see, you know, a open armed rebellion in the streets, and if people are accepting the fact, even tacitly, that the government has a legitimacy, that they accept that this is the person who's been elected, whether he or she should have been elected or reelected is an open question. But if they accept that that's the reality, and they're not scheming to overthrow that particular regime, then it has a form of legitimacy, and you could say it is tacit acceptance of the social contract. Now, the issue that seems to have emerged, or at least in the minds of some during this most recent midterm election, was here you have some people making an issue out of rising crime in the streets of the United States, and particularly in big cities, the crime is on the rise. And the question was, okay, are our governing officials, by looking the other way, by pursuing policies which put criminals who've been arrested back on the street because we have no bail or in the name of criminal justice reform, are they violating the social contract to provide basic protection? You know, in other words, the basic protection is physical protection, that you can be secure in your person to walk the streets safely and not have to worry about being assaulted, killed, murdered, whatever. The point is that is the basic those are the basic contours of a social contract. What form of government you create is an open question. But and the reality is there never really was a social contract where people lived in what Hobbes and Locke called a state of nature. Well, Hobbes described the state of nature as life being nasty, brutish, and short. Basically a lawless society, but didn't exist. There's always been a government of some sort, and the question is, we're trying to rationalize the kind of government that exists in a particular time and place. So there never really was a time we entered a social contract, except maybe for, you know, the Constitutional Convention, 1787, where we actually created the Constitution of the United States. So basically, that, well, you could say, okay, that was a form of social contract, of sorts. But it was a contract between the states and the national government. It wasn't really between the people and the government of the United States. So, but basically, it's a literary device. You could argue, and many have, that the American Revolution was based on the justifications that Locke provided for the Glorious Revolution. The sovereign was basically violating people's basic rights of the social contract, and therefore they were within their rights to rise up in rebellion, overthrow the British government. That was the argument that was used in 1776. In fact, if you read the Declaration of Independence, it basically lists all the offenses of the British Crown. The British Crown did this, the British Crown did that, blah, blah, blah. Now, they use the term British Crown because the Crown is sovereign. Never mind the fact that the British Crown didn't really have as much, had a little more power than it does now, but not much more power. So basically, it was a British government, the Prime Minister, basically, calling the shots. You had royal governors in the colonies who were reporting to the British government back in England. So, you know, never mind that. But basically, listed all his offenses of the British Crown, and basically, it sounds like what Locke is saying.
Well, when do we know that we've gone over the edge? Like, for example, we have a lot of people who are being killed on the streets of New York, in the subways. People are being pushed onto the tracks and get killed. People are being stabbed left and right. There's supposed to be all sorts of violence everywhere you look. When does it get to the point where the public gets so angry and so afraid for their own personal well-being, financial and physical and so on and so forth? Is there a mechanism really today that would require a sovereign to do certain things, like the mayor of the city of New York? Does he have to do something, or do we have to riot in order to get to that point? And when do we do that?
Yeah, I mean, basically, you have to. The situation would have to be so extreme that there's a clamoring for some kind of action. Now the question is, what does that clamoring look like? You know, how many people have to be killed before somebody says we have to do something here? And how do you know it's a problem? Just because you turn on the television and said you see a few segments on Fox News, and therefore that constitutes a serious problem. I want to say, really, that imagery, as horrific as it may be, is nothing more than anecdote. That's not real data that tells you anything about rising crime.
That could be
one-off,
right?
It could be, but if you play it over and over again, it just creates this. Image in the minds of many people that it must be a serious problem. The sort of it is enough people have to respond to it to basically say, okay, if the government's not, or the local government is not responding to these problems now, then if we get enough people, we can mobilize them to vote that local government out and replace it with another one. You know, new public officials, then you sort of have an answer to your question. What was also greatly misunderstood about Locke is basically what he was saying was, look, and he's basically interpreted by people on the right, conservatives to be, well, he's really an individualist who doesn't believe in communitarianism at all. But the truth is, what he's saying is if you feel that the sovereign is violating your basic rights to property, then you have to organize the community to come to that conclusion. Only when the community as a whole comes to that conclusion can the community rise up in rebellion and overthrow the sovereign. So it's really a communal effort. It has to be.
And so
one individual can't do it alone.
But has that concept been ameliorated over time? Are we become lazy? Are we not demonstrating where we should? Are we being mollified somehow or another by our politicians who've got a gift for gab, but they don't really respond to the issue? What's going on? And how, is our society alive and well in the sense that they know their rights and they know what's going wrong? And do they feel empowered?
I think it's just human nature, and maybe it's hubris, but, you know, those in power never admit that they made a mistake. We see that time and time again. Biden never makes mistakes, even though the evidence seems to be to the contrary. As look at Donald Trump. He never makes a mistake. He sort of doesn't admit to them, even though it's clear that he's hanging around with the wrong people. But, you know, he blames others for being disloyal because, you know, for pointing out the fact that he's an anti-Semite or he's hanging around with anti-Semites. That's, you know,
But it's not the anti-Semitism that matters so much, but even though it does matter, but when do our elected officials step over the line? When do we know that it's inappropriate? And is our legal system aware? Or do they let people off when they shouldn't? So they don't inform us because we don't know what's going on.
So the legal system is also a political process too. Is that to say?
Yes.
To say that the prosecutors don't enjoy discretion is not true. Prosecutors prosecute when they feel there's political pressure to prosecute. Some things are obviously, run of the mill. On autopilot, people commit certain crimes, and you're going to be prosecuted. But some things are just not clear. Has the law been broken? Do we know the law's broken? At what point should the prosecutor prosecute? And only when enough public pressure mounts does the prosecutor step in and prosecute. Some cases, the prosecutor may resist public pressure to prosecute. And that's where the line is then ultimately drawn when sufficient popular pressure mounts that the prosecutor has to, in fact, act. And you could say the same thing with rising crime in the streets. When there's enough public pressure to do something, then the prosecutor may, in fact, do something. I mean, I think we saw this to a certain extent with this, person who was assaulted in his bodega, and then he ended up killing the assailant. So what did the prosecutor in New York do? He rushed in to charge the person who was self-defending, the person who was defending himself in the bodega with murder.
Yeah.
Because the assailant was a person of color, therefore it must have been racially motivated. That was the initial conclusion that the prosecutor drew. Ultimately, there was sufficient popular pressure that he ended up having to drop the charges. But he couldn't come to that conclusion on his own. He had to basically go through his machinations. Like, well, we did an exhaustive investigation, blah blah blah. So basically, he would be absolved of any responsibility.
That's really very interesting because I think it touches on our bias because we're not a homogeneous society. Is that one of the problems that makes the United States unique? Because we're at each other's throats, not always, but sometimes, and the ethnic bigotry is there, and it permeates so much of our thinking and our conduct, legally and illegally. So where do we go, or are we moving in the right direction as a nation?
Well, arguably, we've survived as a nation. Heterogeneity. Again, early political thinkers argued that you know, traditional liberal structures would not work because you know, because of what the country grows and basically becomes more heterogeneous and you have more diversity, you're going to have more extremes and more divergent opinions, and very basically ultimately you will be at each other's throats. But the early thinkers talked about republican government, small r, which basically would be homogeneous societies. Basically, you needed homogeneity in order to recognize there was one public good as opposed to multiple public goods. Because in a heterogeneous society, it wouldn't be clear on just what the public good would be.
Right. Wow. Amazing. And so are we following a standard that Hobbes came up with that makes sense for us, or are we like an aberration, not in a negative way necessarily, but just an aberration of that concept, except for the standards, you know, like where the sovereign is supposed to protect us and protect our property and protect our rights? Is our sovereign, whoever he or she may be, whether it be on the presidential level, on the congressional level, on the Senate level, on the local level, on the state level, are they doing what needs to be done to protect us? Because sometimes it doesn't seem that they are.
Again, it's an open question what we mean by protection these days. I mean, early contract theorists talked about physical protection. And it was very simple. Now, you could talk in 2022, now soon to be 2023. You're talking about, you know, you could talk about economic protection. If I'm not protected from starvation, is the sovereign failing to provide me with basic protection? If I'm not protected in my health because the sovereign has failed to provide adequate health care, then am I really being protected? Is the social contract, in fact, being violated? What are the contours of a social contract? And I think we changed that through every electoral cycle when we make a decision as to who will govern us. And we're obviously fighting over that. But the reality is, if we're not taking to the streets, and we take to the streets and we protest, but if we're not taking to the streets in an armed conflict, then the system is working to a certain degree. And if the next election comes along, you're going to see a peaceful transfer of power, then and nobody's rising up, then people are tacitly accepting the social contract. Who's it working for? That has been the question that has been driving people to think about this and write for quite some time now. Obviously, those who study Congress and the legislative process are going to tell you the system is working best for those who have the resources, those who are affluent. The Congress is more responsive to those with money than it is to those who don't have money.
Yeah, well, you've been mentioning that for a long time, and it's so true, it's so valid, it's so correct, Hargett. Have we been able to get beyond, let's say, revolution or people demonstrating their interests, through, I don't know, peaceful means, walking down a particular highway or having a gathering at Central Park or wherever they want to gather in a peaceful way? Do we really know what's going on, or so many of us are oblivious to what's happening in government? And then government is also not telling us what they're doing quite often. So it's a discovery. Sometimes the media tells us, sometimes the media doesn't. Sometimes there are those that know and others that don't know. You know, we've been removed from the equation. We're no longer impotent, really, to demonstrate.
We're having a discussion right now over to what extent social media is engaging in censorship and to what extent it's preventing us from knowing things that maybe we ought to know. mm-hmm. at any given period of time. But the reality is there's always been censorship of some one form or another. Editors of major
Correct.
Newspapers always decided, you know, what was newsworthy, what was not newsworthy, what did we
Absolutely
need to know.
Right.
You know, the Wall Street Journal would publish different stories than the New York Times and the Washington Post.
Yeah. Right.
The thinking was, are newspapers obligated to present the same stories in the same fashion? Are they required to provide equal time to opposing opinion? And the thinking, for a period of time, there was an equal time rule when it came to the major networks before you had cable. But then the Supreme Court changed that, and they basically said, look, as long as when you have cable, people have the ability to flip through the channels and pick the station that they want to hear see that conforms to their viewpoint. So, but the opposing viewpoint is available on another station. Whether people, mm-hmm. you know, actually do that to get two sides of the story is an open question. People tend to pick the station which basically presents the views that are consistent with their own, which means they're not really getting the opposing view at all. This is an ongoing discussion. But, you know, obviously censorship does exist. Do governing officials profit from that? We know to a certain extent it does help them to a certain extent. Can you have enough mounting pressure to change the story? I think at some point we will see that you probably can. What it looks like, again, is always an open discussion. One of the things that has been lacking in all the details of democracy, you know, the Democrats will scream and yell about our democracy, this is an assault on our democracy, laws that require people to show picture IDs at voting booths are an act of voter suppression, things like that. But the one thing that they have not talked about in all this is the fact that when you pay low wages to people, the people mm-hmm. who are paid low wages are least likely to participate in civic affairs, as the gauge of civic participation, of which voting is the most nominal form of civic participation. But in fact, when people's wages rise and they earn livable wages, they are more likely to participate. They're more likely to vote. So in other words, there's a connection mm-hmm. between one's income and participation in public affairs, particularly in voting. So arguably, you can make the case that we want to talk about voter suppression. Paying low wages is a form of voter suppression.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's quite often not recognized by a lot. You know, it's interesting. I speak to this guy, John Bailey, from the White Plains Citizenet Reporter. They're based out in White Plains, naturally, online website. And I've known him for over 20 years. And we actually got started together. He opened up his business when I opened up mine about 25 years ago. And there was a third one that was based out of Scarsdale, but I don't think he's doing it anymore. But what was interesting is that he's always focused on the number of people that are becoming infected with COVID. And he's been reporting it at least 2, 3, 4 times a week. And yet what was fascinating is that even though the numbers kept on rising, that a lot of people didn't seem to know about it, and the information wasn't out there. Even people in Westchester County that you would have thought would be able to opine about it because they had the knowledge, they didn't. And what was always fascinating is how the public, they didn't know how to respond to it all. But then again, I realized at the end, just like you mentioned, not everybody's reporting about this. I read the New York Times every day, and they hadn't been reporting about the number of people who are getting infected with COVID-19. And then you have other places that now say, well, you don't need to get the inoculation or it's no good or there's some sort of conspiracy theory about the people who create this stuff. And it goes on and on and on. And the New York Times didn't write about it, except only a couple of days ago they started to write about it. And we didn't know what the numbers were because they kept silent about it. So we don't get the news all the time from all the places that we read. And I guess if you're not paying attention on a particular issue, then you don't even know that it's omitted. Because it's like forgotten.
Well, the question was the story about rising COVID numbers, or was the story about a particular interest that wanted to suppress information about that, or a particular interest that basically wanted to argue that there was a conspiracy, or particular groups that wanted to say all the restrictions were basically an assault on our civil liberties or civil rights or whatever,
mm-hmm.
or vaccine mandates were offensive, that kind of thing. What was the story
right.
exactly? Once the President of the United States has declared COVID over, nobody has to cover it anymore. Numbers are rising and cases are rising again. And the reality is it's a problem that's not going to go away anytime soon. We may have moved from a pandemic to an endemic at this point, but it's still there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. So it's hard. I guess it's very difficult because people are of different minds, different intellects, different capacity to comprehend or not comprehend, or they have no interest in this particular issue because they're involved in something else. Can there be balance, or is it just we're just so different from one another, even in a homogeneous society? I don't know if we all think the same way. The Japanese are pretty much one population with one demeanor, basically the same religion, and so on and so forth, some less and some more so religious than others, but basically they have a society, and they function within that society. It's different in Korea, different in China, different in the United States. So, what affects us more than in other places? Is it because of our unique structure in the United States that affects us either poorly or well? And how do we know?
Again, I think what you have in the United States versus other countries is you have more of an individualistic cultural tradition. And
yes.
a tradition which basically says the individual is paramount and government should allow the individual to do as the individual pleases for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
There's not this corporate mentality or corporate culture as you have, say, in France, where the community comes first and the individual comes second. And again, that's also a function of, French social contract theorist being Jean-Jacques Rousseau had a different take on social contract theory than the English theorists. So the cultural tradition has a lot to do with it, and how we view government. We view government with suspicion. Whatever government is doing, even when they are people that we agree with, we still view them with suspicion, where, government is a force for good in say, France. In fact, the highest, the most noble profession in the United States is you can be an attorney, you can be a physician, scientist, and well-educated. Those are the professions you want to go into.
Right.
France, civil servant is the most noblest profession. They get the cream of the crop, too.
Yes, they do. Unbelievable. Yes, that's right. That's a very discerning understanding on your part. I really didn't think about it. Is that the problem? It's people like me who exhibit an ignorance about so much. Is there enough? Can we learn enough to be able to be, a countermeasure to what's happening to us, or the type that will applaud the conduct of what's happening to us because we recognize the validity of it? Or are we just maybe not, I'm not talking about other people, but let's say my own simplicity of not understanding what needs to be done. And government has a different thinking process. They're probably more interested in just staying in power. And I would just like to have good government, whatever that means.
I think, you know, again, that's a school of thought that's out there. It's a public choice theory, but basically said governing officials have their own interests, and that is to basically to stay in power. And by whatever means possible, they will stay in power. They're not really there to serve the public interest. And only when serving the public interest serves their own interest, then you could say some semblance of the public interest emerges. But it doesn't always represent the interests of all people all the time.
Yeah. So do you find that based on Hobbes's ideas and other philosophers who've actually engaged us knowingly or unknowingly, and this is our society is based on so much of these platforms that were laid out over the centuries, are we still changing? Does society still have the capacity to change? And do you see the direction that we're heading toward? Is it better? Is it worse? We seem to be in greater strife than we used to be as a nation.
We're certainly more polarized, or at least people think we're more polarized than we were a couple centuries ago. But I think people who say that don't really recognize the history of the United States or haven't really studied it terribly well.
Right.
We were polarized in the 1800 election between Jefferson and Adams, and that was a very polarizing election, and that was a polarizing period. And the question was, what was the direction the country was going to take? The Hamiltonians wanted to take us in the direction of industrializing society, and the Jeffersonians wanted to take us in the direction of a more agrarian society. So that was very polarizing at the time. It was certainly polarized in the run-up to the Civil War, during the Civil War, and following the Civil War. That was also a polarizing period of time. And the end result was warfare. So polarized. Some people think that we could be heading in the same direction now. I'm not so sure. We haven't reached it yet. So it's, but still, the ingredients may be there. So we do have these periods of polarization, and the system is going to continue, you know, limping along as best as it can. But the fact that the country has survived is probably a sign that we're not in as much trouble as people may think. However, we could argue that the contours of the social contract clearly have changed. It's not the same social contract as 1787. And basically, the role of government is viewed very differently than it was back then. It's no longer this idea that government should be totally limited, but government has a role to play in making sure that people's basic needs are met, and that there is something called people's needs that government has a responsibility to fulfill. To a certain extent, you know, later social contract theorists came along. People like Jeremy Bentham, who basically talked about pure democracy, the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people, that was utilitarianism. But utilitarianism does not protect individual rights. Basically, if the majority wants to discriminate against the minority, and that's the greatest happiness, so be it. But that's the majority will. That's the basic flaw in Bentham. John Rawls comes along later on his theory of justice, a monumental work, and which is basically still, I think, being read throughout the world. And this is published in 1971, where it talks about, okay, government has an obligation to protect people's rights. So he's arguing against utilitarianism. But then he goes on to say government should provide for least advantaged members of society. So in other words, it can violate the rights of individuals at the top of the distribution if it's to protect the least advantaged members of society. Now, to a certain extent, we sort of live by that in what we call a modern welfare state. You know, if, when you start taxing people at higher levels of income to redistribute income to people at the bottom of the distribution, what you are doing in effect is you're violating their absolute rights to keep all their wealth themselves. And that, you know, is a certain liberty that is being, you know, violated. When you think about it and put it in the real context, so much so that a constitutional amendment had to be added to the Constitution to allow for government to have a federal tax in 1913. Now, before that, it was unconstitutional for the federal government to impose an income tax because it would be violating people's rights. I earned this money. What do you mean you're taking money away from me? So basically that was a constitutional amendment. So basically saying your rights are not absolute and you do have a responsibility to pay for certain services. You live in a community. And the community is writ large, the United States as a whole, but you have an obligation. So now Rawls comes along and says, but if it's for the betterment of those at the bottom of the distribution to help the least advantaged members of society, then you're not violating what he called the priority of the right over the good. That the, you know, basically the right, protecting people's rights for over the sense that most of us think it would be a good thing to do X, Y, and Z, that kind of thing.
Well, what do we do about things like we have people who work upstate New York and I guess in other communities as well. They pick the fruits and they do things like that. They don't get very well paid. They don't get very well paid. They're not in a good state financially. Why is it okay for us to pay less when they're not getting paid a rightful wage? And who's to decide what is a rightful wage for them as opposed to our holding on to, instead of spending $1.99 for a pound of something, we would need really to come in and spend 279 cents a pound for something. And this way they would get a living wage and we wouldn't have to subsidize them and they wouldn't be subsidizing us. Is that part of the inequity of our society?
It's, you know, the tension that exists is between efficiency and equity, particularly in a capitalist marketplace. So on one hand, you want an efficient marketplace. And efficiency basically dictates, you know, in order to keep prices sufficiently low, in order to have mass consumption, costs of production have to be kept low. And the major factor in the production process is the cost of labor. So labor prices have to be low. So the maxim that capitalist socialism lives by is minimization of costs, maximization of profits. That's considered to be efficient if you can pay as low wages as possible. In theory, we're all going to benefit from this. Well, we're going to benefit in the form of lower prices, lower costs. We as consumers want low costs. We want to be able to go into Walmart and buy whatever we want at the cheapest price possible. Never mind the fact that Walmart's the biggest exporter of jobs. But, you know, we pay for this. And yet we seem, but then we, in an interest group society, we talk about, okay, the minimum wage requires an act of Congress in order to legislate it. Now you can have interest groups protesting such a move to say, well, my right as a consumer will be violated if the rights of if the cost of those goods that I'm purchasing go up because you're paying workers higher wages. So what's in the public interest here? Paying the workers a livable wage or consumers having goods at a price that they can afford or lower price.
Well, Well, that's one of the problems. For example, when I go to the supermarket, I can buy blueberries that come from Chile or from Peru at less than what they probably would earn if they were picking the blueberries in upstate New York. So who's benefiting here? Are we benefiting as a consumer because it's costing us less to buy more blueberries at $2.99 for a container as opposed to needing to spend more for New York blueberries? So why do we permit this to come in? Isn't that upsetting our society?
It is upsetting our society, but we think we're benefiting because we're getting our blueberries at a cheaper price. We're not paying attention to the fact that we're also paying higher taxes to subsidize low-wage workers, which is really subsidizing the profits of their employers. So, it's a tension that exists. What's more important, equity or efficiency? If you say equity is more important than efficiency, then the marketplace is no longer a capitalist marketplace in the minds of many. It becomes more socialist. You have a socialist marketplace that functions according to market principles? To a certain extent, you can, but you don't want. But then you have the slippery slope that your socialist economy will then gravitate towards a more Soviet-style command economy. That's always the concern that's there. That's the fear that people play on, the fear-mongering that people on the right engage in when they basically want to argue against being concerned about equity in the marketplace. But I would suggest to you, when we have these discussions about what constitutes democracy and protecting our democracy as the narrative was put forth, we really ought to be mindful of, those at the bottom of the distribution, are they able to participate? If their incomes are insufficient, then enable them to participate.
They can't. They don't.
And yet, if we're not going to have that discussion, then let's not insult everybody with discussions of our protecting our democracy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's the real issue. Because we talk a good game, but we're not delivering to every member of society. Prudently, I mean, there are limits to what you could do. You can't be giving $1 million to everybody who doesn't have it, but then not everybody needs $1 million for anything particular. That's like over the top. But certainly you need a living wage. And if people had a living wage and people would pay for the products that are being produced on a reasonable level, wouldn't we all be better off? And wouldn't we have less subsidy because there wouldn't be a need for it?
Well, again, it's a cycle. So, yes, we have the wages, but prices of goods would go up. There was a Wall Street Journal editorial this morning talking about how the Fed's job is not done. The inflation report was better than everyone was expecting, so the pressures on inflation seem to be easing. Okay, so if the Fed traditionally responds to inflationary pressure, and that then increases its interest rates, or the interest rate charges to member banks, and it's best the best interest rate charges. Okay, fine.
Yeah.
Now, what that invariably does is the higher you raise interest rates, since unemployment and inflation are inversely related, as you raise interest rates, you're going to basically bring on a recession. You're reducing a recession. That's the goal of raising interest rates. You want to have a recession to bring prices down because you want to restrict demand for goods and services. You want to make it impossible for people to buy and for companies to expand. Because the money, cost of money has increased. So the recession is going to bring prices down. That's the thinking. So that the editorial was saying is, okay, interest rate, the overall inflation is down. That's a good thing, but we have a long way to go to achieve this so-called 2% inflationary rate because food prices are still high. The argument goes, but then it mentioned wages have been going up. So they're basically saying, oh, the fault here are obviously with workers whose wages are going up. Wages going up is a terrible thing because it's inflationary. That's mm-hmm. what the Wall Street Journal seems to be saying, which is, you know, mimics a lot of the views of those on the right who basically say, well, if we raise the minimum wage, we'll have inflation. The prices mm-hmm. of goods will go up. Landlords will start charging more money for renting properties and so on and so forth. Have a spiral effect. Now, I've said this before, so I'll say it again. There's probably something called good inflation versus bad inflation, just like there's good cholesterol versus bad cholesterol. Mm-hmm. And we don't really make that distinction, but I think we do need to make that distinction in the marketplace. When wages are going up, you want wages to go up so people can have a better standard of living. That would be probably good inflation. Will lead to an increase in prices to a certain extent, but probably not to the same extent as the increase mm-hmm. in wages.
Yeah. Well, that would be more balanced. Much more balanced. Unbelievable. What a fascinating, essay that you came up with again, as you do every time, which is really phenomenal. Any last words from you, Professor?
Not this time.
Well, first of all, my apology because of my own medical issues. I wasn't able to put your article up in time. We should have been speaking about this issue 2 weeks ago, but we haven't, so thanks for your patience. I'm glad we were able to do this today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All the best. Take care. There we have it, folks, none other than Oren M. Levin-Waldman. He's the socioeconomic research scholar. And bear with me a moment, because I did notice that I didn't have everything in place, which I should have. So bear with me a moment, because I'm going to find what I'm looking for in a moment, because I've got to find it on the website. And so bear with me a moment here, and hopefully we will get to it. This will probably be here. Bear with me a second here. Okay, no, that was not it. Thought it would be, but it wasn't, so bear with me a second. Trying to look this up, and hopefully we'll be able to find it. And one more second, a little further, forgive me. Okay, hopefully we'll find it here. Yeah, I think so. Okay. Well, one thing you should know, if you want to learn more about the professor's the books that he's written, as well as his website, which I think you'll find fascinating, you could certainly go to his website, which is called Labor Econ. And yet the web address is different. It's HTTPS because it's secure. And then the web address is www.econlabor.com. So econlabor.com. You could certainly reach him at his office at 914-629-6351. And let's look at some of the work that he's already done. He's a published author. And one of his works is called Restoring the Middle Class Through Wage Policy, Arguments for a Middle Class. And this is issued by Palgrave, Palgrave. Then I was introduced to him through a publication called Understanding Public Policy in the United States. And this was issued by Top Hat. Top Hat is the publisher. And my mistake, this was not the one that I was introduced to him about. It was another one called The Minimum Wage, a Reference Handbook. And this was issued by ABC, the American Broadcasting Corporation. They have a division called CLIO, So it's ABC-CLIO, and you could find his work there. That was the minimum wage and reference handbook. And then one of the most esoteric publishers in the nation, particularly on this sort of field, is Routledge, R-O-U-T-L-E-D-G-E. Routledge is the publisher, and the book that he wrote is called Wage Policy, Income Distribution, and Democratic Theory. And it's also in paperback, which is fascinating. It's an unbelievable read. And to be honest with you, the first time I read it, it went right over my head. And I'm sure, even though I may not have realized that the second time I read it, it went over my head, it probably did. Anyway, I mean, I am not on the same intellectual capacity, certainly not in this particular field, as a professor. Anyway, another book that he wrote is called The Case of the Minimum Wage. It's called, the subheading is Competing Policy Models, which is fascinating. And this one was published by the State University of New York Press. So SUNY Press, and again, The Case of the Minimum Wage and Competing Policy Models. So certainly if you want to find out more about his work and go directly to his website, simply go to www.econlabor.com and you'll find him there. Again, the phone contact for him if you want to reach out to his office with an inquiry is 914-629-6351. Wow. How exciting, to say the least. Now, let's look at some other things that you may find of interest. And bear with me a moment. Okay, bear with me a second as I try to put this up. One second. I think you'll find this really fascinating. It seems that more journalists have been imprisoned or killed in the year of 2022. The number of media professionals killed or imprisoned has risen this year. China and Iran are the most dangerous countries, and women are the most at risk. And the war in Ukraine has added a new dimension. It seems the number of journalists killed in 2022 up to December 1 was 20% higher than in the same period last year, reversing a two-year downtrend, according to media watchdog Reporters Without Borders, RSF. Well, Russia's war against Ukraine played a major role in the increase. Reporters Without Borders researcher Christopher Resch had advised 8 journalists have been killed there since the war began, making the country the second most dangerous in the world for media professionals and pushing the number of journalists killed on the job to 57 compared to 48 in 2021. Well, organized crime and corruption has a big effect. Mexico heads the list. 11 journalists were killed there this year. That was 4 more than in 2021, putting the country at the top of the list of the most dangerous countries for the 4th year in a row. In most cases, the deaths are linked to investigations into drug trafficking and organized crime. Investigating journalists run the biggest risk for their lives when there is a connection between organized crime, politics, and corruption, according to the Press Freedom Monitor. In Mexico, local media representatives are in the most danger. This is different from war reporting, where media professionals are flown to the battlefield to report on the ground, said Christopher Resch. And together with a partner organization in Mexico, Reporters Without Borders has been campaigning for years for better protection for media professionals who often risk their lives. But despite some government measures, quote, virtually nothing has happened, he said. In January alone, 3 male journalists and 1 female journalist were murdered in Mexico. Unbelievable. Media professionals killed on the job were reporting on the ground in war and conflict areas. That was 20. On organized crime, 13. On corruption, 12. On social unrest, protests, and elections, 7. On expropriation or environmental destruction, 4. Well, 533 journalists are in prison. 7 female journalists have been killed this year, which is more than 12% of all victims. 15% of the journalists in prison are women, 78 of a total of 533, more than ever before. The number of women journalists behind bars has increased by 28% on 2021. About a quarter of them are in prison in China and Iran, respectively. RSF researcher Christopher Resch pointed to targeted repression of women in Iran and Belarus. Quote, this is deliberately used to spread more terror and fear of repression, he said. Well, Julian Assange is the most prominent detainee. To improve the situation for all professionals in journalism, including camera operators and producers, Reporters Without Borders is pushing for compliance with internationally agreed upon standards around the world. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights provided the framework for protection, said Resch. And we speak to, I'm on so much medication, to be honest with you, sometimes I forget people's names more than anything else. I don't know, but we speak to him usually every second week. And he is the author of, protecting people's rights. And he was the one that put together, bear with me a second, where did I put this? One moment here. Okay, one second. Yeah, that's it. He's the author of, one of the major authors of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Absolutely fascinating. So what's fascinating is actually the fact that we speak to him, and again, my mind is shot. And last week, I wasn't able to make it because I had to go to hospital. So what was fascinating is that there's so much honesty and integrity in the writing, and yet it hasn't been inculcated, it hasn't been made part of the demeanor of many societies. And it's not that I question the integrity of its writing, its thinking, its demeanor, because I don't. What I find upsetting and unnerving is that it isn't promoted enough. Not by individuals that you would think, but you would think that government would be promoters of this concept, and because it speaks to governance, it speaks to people. It speaks to humanity. It speaks to the integrity of the human being, of the different sexes, of different standards and lifestyles, and so on and so forth. And yet we try to overlook it as if it's non-existent. And it is very much in existence. And the ones, I guess, that want to avoid looking at it are the ones that hope people will not know of it. Never become aware of this concept, which is known as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Absolutely breathtaking, you must know. And it's great for me. It was great to see that this was written and mentioned by Deutsche Welle, the German publication, and they mentioned the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is fascinating. It's interesting. One of the authors for Universal Declaration of Human Rights is Shulamit Koenig. Shulamit is a Hebrew name, but Koenig is a German name, which means king. And So this woman who was one of the authors, she must have spoken German as well. And maybe it's better known in Germany than it is here in the United States, which is fascinating. And even though I speak Hebrew, I don't remember it ever being inculcated in Israel. It may have been, it probably was. I have to really look into it. Hopefully I'll remember to do that. Anyway, so that's one of the fascinating things about that. Bear with me a moment, because I want to move on to some other issues with you. And I appreciate patience with me today, because I realize I'm not always there mentally at times. Okay. Well, this is really very important because the world is going to be watching this. Morocco is going to face France in the World Cup semifinal after a historic run of wins. So the French face the World Cup history makers Morocco in the World Cup semifinals. That's today, with Lionel Messi's Argentina lying in wait after another dazzling performance from the diminutive magician. So it's going to be really, really fascinating. So the Copa America champions swept aside the 2018 World Cup finalist Croatia 3-0 on Tuesday to give the seven-time Ballon d'Or winner to crown his career in style. Defending champions France, no victory against surprise package Morocco would leave them just one win away from becoming the first team in 60 years to successfully defend the trophy. Didier Deschamps, that's France, France, are heavy favorites to win the Al Bayt Stadium, but face Al Bayt is probably meaning the home stadium. But face a team that have conceded just once in their extraordinary run on the semifinals. The France captain, Hugo Lloris, is desperate to avoid the whiff of complacency for a team who have become used to competing at the sharp end of tournaments. So when a team is capable of beating Belgium, Spain, and Portugal, and finish top of their group, it is because they have lots of quality on the field and absolutely and undoubtedly off it too in terms of cohesion and team spirit, Lloris had said. They will be formidable opponents, and on top of that, there will be a hostile atmosphere in the stadium. Deschamps' team are closing in on a third World Cup triumph in seven tournaments, but will be aware that no team have retained the World Cup since Pelé's Brazil side performed defeat in 1962. The world champions are unwilling to have it all their own way against a tough Morocco team. They topped a group containing Croatia and Belgium before beating Spain on penalties and then dumping Cristiano Ronaldo's Portugal out of the tournament. Morocco are the first African side and the first Arab nation to reach the semifinals of a World Cup. Well, the game will have added spice given France was Morocco's colonial power and more than a million Moroccans live in the country. Their not-so-secret weapon on Wednesday will be the incredible support from fans in the stadium and across the Arab world. There is a popular faith behind them, said Deschamps. It will be very noisy, and my players have been warned about that. They know what to expect. Morocco coach Walid Regragui, who was born near Paris and spent most of his playing career in the French league, believes his team have become the neutral's favorite. But he is adamant his side are not just there to make up the numbers. Quote, if we are happy just to reach the semifinals and come see that as enough, I don't agree, said Regragui. If you get to the semifinals and you are not hungry, then there is a problem. The best team in the tournament, Brazil, is already out. We are an ambitious team, and we are hungry, but I don't know if that will be enough, he added. On Tuesday, Messi converted a penalty in the first half against Croatia to pull level with France hotshot Kylian Mbappe in the leading scorers race on 5 goals. Manchester City forward Julian Alvarez doubled Argentina's lead shortly before halftime after bursting through the middle, aided by 2 fortunate bounces. Messi then produced a moment of magic in the 69th minute to set up Alvarez for his second, which killed the game and set up the 35-year-old for another shot at history after he suffered a bitter defeat to Germany in the 2014 final. Argentina are once again in the World Cup final. Enjoy it, said the Argentine great. We've been through tough situations, other very good ones. Today, we're experiencing something spectacular. It's unbelievable. You know, a player, a leader, just immense, huge, huge. It is absolutely breathtaking what he's brought to the game. Absolutely amazing. And yet he's 34 years of age. My God. Talk about old age, and here I am twice his age. So I guess you could last a hell of a lot longer at my age than you can at his age doing what he does as compared to what I do. Unbelievable. 1 second. This is very interesting. U.S. citizen and dozens of Ukrainians have been released in a prison swap with Russia, Kyiv says. Ukraine has secured the release of a U.S. citizen and 64 Ukrainian soldiers in a prison swap with Russia, the Ukrainian presidency's chief of staff said today. Earlier in the day, there were multiple explosions near Ukraine's capital of Kyiv, but no casualties have been reported. And so we'll see where things go. The Red Cross chief sees a possibility of all-for-all prisoner swap deal in Ukraine. The head of the International Committee of the Red Cross said on Wednesday that she saw the possibility of a major prisoner of war swap deal in the Ukraine-Russia conflict on an all-for-all exchange. It has happened in the past. It is a known practice. And it can happen in the Russia-Ukraine international conflict as well, Mirjana Spoljaric Ega told reporters. Quote, so this possibility is certainly one that can be taken by the parties. She declined to give further details. Well, the people of Ukraine received the European Parliament's annual Sakharov Prize for Freedom of Thought on Wednesday to honor their fight against Russia's invasion. There is no one more deserving of this prize, said European Parliament President Roberta Metsola at an event with representatives of Ukrainian society who received the prize on behalf of the country's people. The prize, named after the late Soviet dissident Andrei Sakharov, has been awarded annually since 1988 to individuals and organizations defending human rights and fundamental freedoms. Zelensky is urging Europe to back war tribunal for Russian leaders. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky today urged Europe to help set up a tribunal to try Russia's leadership for the crime of aggression as he accepted the European Union's top right award. I call on all of you, he said, your parties and states to effectively support this work. The tribunal must start working, Zelensky told the European Parliament in a speech via video link. Ukraine considers moves to ensure border security, says the president's office. While Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and top military officials discussed moves to ensure border security at a meeting of the Supreme Command on Wednesday, the president's office had said. The office placed particular emphasis on the moves to secure the border in a statement issued after the meeting without saying which part of the border was focused upon. Well, the statement followed a flurry of military activity in neighboring Belarus, an ally of Moscow. Well, there was a release of 64 Ukrainian servicemen, one U.S. citizen was secured in a prisoner swap, Ukraine had said. So Ukraine said on Wednesday that it had secured the release of a U.S. citizen as well as 64 Ukrainian military servicemen in its latest prisoner swap with Russian forces. 64 soldiers of the Ukrainian armed forces who fought in Donetsk and Luhansk in particular participated in the defense of the city of Bakhmut are going home. The Ukrainian presidency's chief of staff, Andriy Yermak, said on social media, it was also possible to free a U.S. citizen who helped our people, Swedi Murekezi, Yermak had said. Russia's state-run TASS news agency has reported that Murekezi was arrested in the Donetsk region of Ukraine in June and charged with attending anti-Russian protests and inciting, quote, ethnic hatred. Well, Russia faces a strike of, Russian forces strike Kherson regional administration building, Ukraine had said. Russian forces firing rockets hit the regional administration building in the city of Kherson today, the deputy head of Ukraine's presidential office had said. Ukraine recaptured Kherson from Russian forces on November 11, prompting days of celebration by residents on the city's central square, where the administration building is located. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky visited the square on November 14 to hail the end of the Russian occupation. Well, Russian forces have been shelling Kherson from the opposite side of the Dnipro River since leaving the city. Well, the Pope calls for people to spend less on Christmas and donate savings to Ukraine. Pope Francis today called on people to spend less on Christmas presents and celebrations and donate money saved to those in war-ravaged Ukraine. It is nice to celebrate Christmas, but let's lower the level of Christmas spending a bit, Francis said in his weekly general audience at the Vatican. Let's have more humble Christmas with more humble gifts. Let's send what we have to the Ukrainian people who need it, he said. Nearly 10 months into the war, hardships from the fighting has compounded as winter sets in and Russia pounds Ukraine's energy infrastructure. The Ukrainians are suffering so much. They are hungry and cold. So many people are dying because there are no doctors or nurses, the Pope said. The Kremlin says it has not received proposals for a Christmas ceasefire. The Kremlin said on Wednesday it had not received any proposals about a Christmas ceasefire in Ukraine. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky called earlier this week on Russia to start withdrawing its troops from Ukraine by Christmas as a first step towards a peace deal in the conflict, which has been raging for almost 10 months. The Kremlin says that the U.S. Patriot missile defense system in Ukraine would be a legitimate target. Kremlin said on Wednesday that U.S. Patriot missile defense systems would be a legitimate target for Russian strikes against Ukraine should the United States authorize the system to be delivered to support Kyiv. Washington is finalizing plans to send the Patriot system to Ukraine, a decision that could be announced as soon as this week, three U.S. officials advised Reuters on Tuesday. But what would this technology mean for Ukraine? Well, reporting from Kyiv, it's been said that something the Ukrainians have been clamoring on for years, for months rather. He explains that the older Soviet-made systems that Ukraine has are seriously running out of ammunition. Well, Russian drone strikes on Kyiv did not damage the power sector, said Ukrenergo, the Ukraine energy company. Russian drone strikes on Kyiv and the region around the Ukrainian capital on Wednesday did not damage any energy facilities, national power grid operator Ukrenergo had said. where Russia has been targeting Ukraine's energy infrastructure with big waves of missiles and drone strikes since October. Thanks to the brilliant work of the air defense forces, the energy infrastructure facilities were not damaged on Wednesday. All 13 drones were shot down, Ukrenergo said on the Telegram messaging app. Well, the villages of Mykolaiv region are without electricity. Back from Ukraine, there are recounts that the difficulties faced by Mykolaiv region inhabitants are weathering icy conditions without power. Many of the villagers haven't had electricity for the last 9 months, said Parsons, foreign editor by the name of Rob Parsons from France 24. The Ukrainian electricians are trying to restore infrastructure in awful conditions while working carefully near mined terrain. Well, don't undermine the European Union with foreign policy vetoes, Scholz warns member states. Seems that the European Union is united in its support for Ukraine, Chancellor Olaf Scholz told the German parliament, adding with apparent reference to Hungary that attempts to undermine the bloc's values by blocking foreign policy measures would fail. Anyone who thinks he can undermine the value of the European Union to which every member state has committed itself by blocking its foreign and security policies will fail in that attempt, he told legislators on Wednesday. Hungary earlier this week dropped its objections to a European Union loan to Kyiv after the partial unfreezing of financial supports for Budapest that had earlier been frozen over the rule of law concerns. Well, Ukraine shot down all 13 drones on the Kyiv attack, says Zelensky. President Volodymyr Zelensky said on Wednesday that Ukrainian air defense systems had shot down 13 Iranian-made kamikaze drones that targeted the capital of Kyiv earlier in the day. Russia, quote, started their morning with 13 Shaheds. All 13 were shot down by our Ukrainian air defense systems, Zelensky said in a video address on social media referring to Iranian-made suicide drones that Moscow has been accused of deploying against targets in Ukraine. Thankfully, the authorities are saying there are no casualties. So that's important. And there are blasts that have been heard in central Kyiv. The mayor of Kyiv is reporting multiple explosions in the Ukrainian capital, the first such blast in weeks. Vitaly Klitschko wrote in a post on Telegram that there were explosions in the central district of the capital that is home to many government agencies and buildings. He said that multiple teams were in place and more details were expected. In a separate post, Klitschko said that air defense systems had shot down 10 Iranian-made Shahed drones among Kyiv. Evidently, U.S. funding grid equipment are U.S. are finding grid equipment for Ukraine at home and abroad. As Washington sends Ukraine U.S. sourced power equipment help the country's grid recover from Russian attacks. It is also scouring for those supplies worldwide, U.S. officials said yesterday. The Biden administration this week shipped the first portion of the $53 million in power equipment aid it announced last month. The open market value is likely to be higher because utilities and manufacturers provided many items at cost and paid transportation costs. They were really quite forthcoming, and energy department officials said about the suppliers, but noted that not all U.S. equipment is compatible with Ukraine's grid. Well, Zelensky says that a swath of Ukraine is contaminated with mines. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky today called for long-term help in clearing the nation's mines and other unexploded ordnances, which he said now cover an area roughly the size of Cambodia. In a video address to New Zealand's parliament, Zelensky described Russia's nearly year-old invasion as an ecocide that would have lasting impact and implored Wellington capital of New Zealand, and others to step up aid. As of now, 174,000 square kilometers or 67,000 square miles of Ukrainian territory are contaminated with mines and unexploded ordnance, Zelensky told lawmakers. Unbelievable. Anyway, that's the story. It's 11:30. We're going to need to close our session with you today. So I'm going to go and end our program. We'll speak to you tomorrow. Take care and be well.